Okay, today we're going to be doing a class on evolution and what it is, what it isn't, what's true and what is not true about evolution. But before we start with that, we have some scripture verses that I would like. We're going to read some of them. Others I'm going to assign you as reading today that you would read them at home. So your home assignments will be Genesis chapter 7. That's the flood story. I would like you to read that just to have that information in mind. Also, Romans chapter 1, verses 19 through 32. I'll be reading a portion of that this morning, but that's the section I would like you to read. If you'd all turn to Genesis 1. Romans 1, 19 through 32. I've got my hearing aids in, and it sounds like I'm shouting. So if I'm not talking loud enough, let me know. I'm not talking loud enough? Okay, well, I'll try to do better. It's really hard to tell because I'm used to not wearing them most of the time. So when I'm, it is difficult. So anybody, if I'm not, wave or do something to let me know that I'm not talking loud enough so you can hear. Okay, Genesis 1:1, we're going to read 1 through 5. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. So the implication here is that prior to that moment, there was no time. Time only has relation to us as mortals to give us a place that we can peg ourselves into. To God, who is immortal, time has no concept. But it's important to understand that light and darkness is what defines a day, and days what? Are defined by minutes, seconds, minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years, decades, centuries, millennia, and so on and so on. Okay? So that's an important concept to keep in mind. If we look at, as I said, Genesis 7, that's your reading assignment. I'd also like you to look at Genesis 3, 5 through 6. And this is the serpent speaking to Eve and apparently Adam at the same time because he was with her. And the serpent said, "For God doth know that in the day that ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise," that's the important word right there, "the tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat." So this was a direct violation of the one rule that God had given Adam and Eve, that they could not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Okay. Psalm 33, if you would turn there. Now, a long time after that Genesis passage that we just read, I'm in trouble with my Psalms here. Okay. So this is Psalm 33, verses 6 through 9. "By the word of the Lord were the heavens made, and all the hosts of them by the breath of his mouth. He gathered the waters of the sea together as a heap. He layeth up the depth in storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spake, and it was done. He commanded, and it stood fast." Okay. Important concept. There is no part of God in his creation. He spoke all that we know into existence by the word of his mouth. So he did not put any of his Godhead, any of his of who he is within the creation. He spoke it into existence. And so we should not worship the creation because there is no creator in the creation. We should worship only the creator. And finally, Romans 1. And I'll be reading a section of verses 19 through 32. The rest of that would be for you to read at home at your convenience. Okay, Romans 1, verses 19 through 32. I'll be reading verses 21 through 23. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man and to birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. Okay, when we lived in Minnesota, we attended a church that had a seminary. Ernest Pickering, you've heard pastors speak of Ernest Pickering, was the president of the seminary at the time, part of the time that we were there. And in one of his messages that he preached, he said in verse 21, when they knew God, that was a direct reference in context to Adam and Eve. Okay, so Adam and Eve made that decision and then passed that on to us as their offspring, as Adam as their federal head of the human race. But because of that decision, the they thou is also us. In other words, we also are very, even if we knew God and glorified him not as God. Okay, well, that tendency is within us. Okay. So, evolution. What is evolution? Well, there are two choices for us. Either that which we know as the creation is created, or it came into existence by pure chance. All right. So, the definition of evolution, originally, when Charles Darwin, who formulated the first definition of evolution, it referred to descent with modification. The current definition of evolution, and it is important to understand definitions so that when people are talking about evolution, you know what they're talking about. Darwin said, descent with modification. The current definition is change over time. And the last common ancestor of all life on the face of the earth was a single cell, according to the evolutionist, that occurred, it came into existence by chance, 3.5 to 4 billion years ago. I don't know about you. I have an awful hard time even understanding 100,000, let alone a million. And billions are a whole bunch of years. Okay? It's a long, long time. So evolution, the evolutionist says, chance through immense time is what caused all living structure that we know of to exist. And not only that, but the geological stuff we see was also the result of immense periods of time with uniform processes being happening, I'm sorry, I misspoke myself, that we can go back and we can look at what's happening today on the geological era of our Earth and we can go back to what it was billions of years ago because it is a uniform, ongoing, slow process. Okay. Evolution requires chance and immense periods of time. So the mechanism is chance working through time. The mechanisms of evolution are twofold. And one is what is Darwin defined as natural selection. Okay. Natural selection is environmental factors that favor one trait over another. And individuals, cells or organisms, possessing that favored trait will be in a competitive advantage over other organisms that don't possess that trait. And consequently, they will be produced in larger numbers, and gradually that trait will become existent within an entire population. In addition to natural selection, there is another factor that absolutely has to happen for evolution to occur, and that is genetic drift. So you have natural selection, which is the environment working on an organism, favoring a particular trait, and then genetic drift, which results from three factors. Genetic drift occurs as a result of inbreeding, hybridization, and mutation. Now, this is, unfortunately, the beginning of this has to be very technical because we have to understand the definition of the words we're dealing with in order to understand the argument. Genetic drift as the result of inbreeding. This would be close. Now, farmers, stock farmers, know a lot about inbreeding. Inbreeding is breeding closely related individuals that has a tendency to concentrate traits within those individuals. And this would be father-daughter mating, this would be mother-son mating, this would be brother-sister mating, this would be cousins mating, this kind of a thing. So very closely related organisms breeding will lead to concentration of genes, we'll talk about that in a minute, that favor a particular trait that you're looking to create or to have in a species. Hybridization would be the breeding of closely related individuals but of different species. For instance, this would be white-tailed deer and mule deer. Where their ranges overlap, they are capable of breeding. And you produce an offspring that is neither a mule deer nor a white-tailed deer, but it is something, it is a hybrid. Classic hybrid would be horse and donkey breeding, which produces a mule. Mules are sterile because they have an odd number of chromosomes, but that's a hybrid animal as well. In poultry farming, they will breed closely related individuals through successive generations, and then they'll have another group of individuals that will breed closely together, and they will become, genetically, those two groups will become very, very similar to one another, and then they crossbreed those, and that produces what's called hybrid vigor. Hybrid vigor is a larger animal, a stronger animal, as a result of what they call crossbreeding from closely related groups of individuals. They do the same thing with corn, okay, as a plant. And then mutation. Mutation is the spontaneous, permanent change in the genes of an individual. So that's a mutation. So those three things have to occur. One of those three things, or combinations of those three things, have to occur in order for evolution to occur. And again, evolution requires change in the genes by chance and then immense periods of time. A gene is a portion of our DNA which controls a trait. If you would look at your handout, there is a very crude line drawing on your third page. And this is a line drawing. This is a Mendelian square. A monk named Mendel was the first one to hypothesize genes, and he proved it with his pea plants. And Mendel was able to show that the color of the blossom of the pea plant was controlled by two genes. And white was a dominant or gene, and pink was recessive. And through breeding experiments, he was able to show that if you took two individuals who had a dominant gene for white, they would have white blossoms, but they carried the recessive gene for pink, and you bred them, those plants, you could predict the outcome of that breeding. And if you look at your square, we have a capital B that stands for the white dominant trait and a little b which would stand for the pink or red recessive trait. So when you make that breeding, all you're doing is going from B to B, B, capital B to capital B, capital B to sub little b, and then little b to and all that. So you can look at that and see what that does. But the point here is three of the four offspring would have white blossoms, even though they are carrying a gene for pink. But because white is dominant in this simple illustration, you only see white blossoms. And only one of the offspring would be have both genes for the recessive trait of pink, and so only one of those plants would have pink blossoms. And he was able to show this through successive breeding, so this was the first time that scientifically we began to get a grasp of how traits show up in individuals. Okay? So that's a simple Mendelian square. Now, most traits are controlled by multiple genes, and consequently it is much more difficult to understand and comprehend than this simple illustration. But for pea plants, this works very well. It also works great for the comb size of chickens. And certain combs are dominant over others, and you can breed them back and forth, and you can predict the percentages of offspring that will have a big comb or a little comb or a rosette comb, as, you know, that kind of stuff. Okay. So genes control physical manifestations of individuals. That's the important thing to realize about that. And some genes are very simple. That is, one gene from the father, one gene from the mother. Maybe both dominant, maybe both recessive, maybe dominant and recessive. But the point is, when only a single pair of genes control a trait, then the dominant trait will always be controlled, and even though you're carrying a recessive gene. The importance of that is to offspring. So you could have two individuals carrying recessive genes for a bad problem. They won't have that problem because the dominant gene controls the situation. But their offspring may. Now, my grandson has a genetic disease, which is called mucolipidosis 3. And in that disease, his cells are unable to excrete waste products. And those waste products build up in his cells over time and gradually destroy the cells. And when the cells die, then an organ dies. And eventually my grandson will die, probably between 12 and 15 years of age. And there is no treatment for this at this time for this particular disease. Neither his father nor his mother had mucolipidosis 3. But they carried the genes for that, and unfortunately, when he was conceived, he received the recessive gene for that disease from both of his parents. And he's what they call homozygous for the recessive gene, meaning both genes are there and he has the disease. Okay. A man named Charles Darwin was born in 1809 and he lived until 1882. Charles Darwin was a well-trained scientist of his day. He was both a botanist, he was a zoologist, and he was a geologist. And he was very well trained in all three of those sciences for his day. In the years 1831 through 1836, he was on a voyage of a British naval vessel called the HMS Beagle, where he was able to go to the Galapagos Islands, which are off the coast of Peru. And they are extremely isolated in the Pacific Ocean. And Darwin observed finches that were very similar to the finches that lived in Peru, but were different from them. Their beak length was different. And that got him thinking about how did this come about. These finches originally all looked like the finches that lived in Peru. But now I've got these finches, which some of them have shorter beaks than the ones in Peru. Some of them have longer. Some of them have hooked beaks. Some of them have straight beaks. And yet they're all finches. They were all capable of inbreeding, so they could hybridize. Although, because they were a species, they tended to breed with one another. And so he said, how in the world did this happen? And that was where he got his idea for natural selection. Remember we talked about that? It's environmental influences that favor one trait over another based on the environment that the individual is living in. So, for instance, if there was a plant that had seeds that the finch would eat, but the seeds were deeply recessed in that plant, a longer beak would be advantageous to that particular finch because he could get to the seed better. Okay? And so because of that, the longer beaked finch would have a competitive advantage over the shorter beaked finch, and you would expect to see a species develop of a finch that had a longer beak because the environment favored that trait in that individual. This was the first time that scientists had any glimmer of thought that the environment actually exerted a selective effect on species. And that's true. It does. Okay? No question about that. But that is what we would call microevolution. That is the change within a species. And remember, from the Latin, species are identified by their genus and their species. So variation from one species to another is called microevolution. But no one has ever been able to show the change of one genus to another. No one has ever been able to show cats becoming dogs or vice versa. Okay? But we can take wild cats from Africa and breed them with domestic cats, and we get something in between. It's called a savanna cat. Savannah cats cannot be sold on the F1, which would be the first cross, but if they took an F1 and bred it back to another domestic cat, that's an F2 generation, they can sell those. And those are called savannah cats. The cat from Africa is called a serval. It's a medium-sized cat, wild cat. Savannah cats can be 35 pounds, can be 4.5 feet long, including their tail. They are a prodigious creature. But the original cross of a serval cat with a domestic cat is so wild that they're not safe to be sold and cannot be purchased in the United States. But you can take that hybrid and breed it back to a domestic cat, and those you can buy. Why anybody would want a 35-pound cat in their house, I'm not sure, but you could do that. Okay. So that's microevolution. Basically, what you're doing is selectively breeding to create. Now, those individuals will breed true over time. Okay. In my science book in high school, there was a picture of a white moth and a dark moth. And in England, prior to the Industrial Revolution, in the beech woods of England, the white moths predominated over the dark moths, although there was a small population of dark moths. Beech trees have a very, not here because you got a disease that affects the beech trees here, but in Michigan we don't, at least not yet. So beech trees have a beautiful, smooth, silvery bark in Michigan, and they have leaves that frost to a really gorgeous yellow. So a beech woodlot in the fall is beautiful. Silver trunks, beautiful yellow leaves, smooth bark. You can run your hand up and down and scarcely feel any indentation in the barks at all. No. And that was the trees that were in England. And then, so the white moths would land on the bark, and the birds could see the dark moths against the white light bark much easier than they could see the light moths, so they preferentially ate dark moths because they could see them. Then the Industrial Revolution came along. England has soft coal, bituminous coal, which produces a lot of smoke and a lot of soot. We have a lot of anthracite coal in the United States, which produces not as much soot and less smoke. Now, all these factories are belching out all this smoke from coal fires, and the bark of the trees started to get covered with the soot. And guess what? They darkened up. All of a sudden, the white moths were now more visible against the dark trunks. So the birds, opportunistic as they are, started eating white moths more than dark moths because the dark moths blended in. And guess what? The population changed completely. They went from predominantly white moths with a few dark moths to predominantly dark moths with a few white ones. That is natural selection. Absolutely no question about it. But the jump that was made in my high school science book was that this was a mechanism for the creation of a new genus. And that you cannot do. That's not what happened. Those dark moths were present, but when the tree trunks darkened up, they had a competitive breeding edge because of that. They were not eaten as rapidly as the white moths, and so the population changed. But they were still the same moths. They had not changed from a moth to a dragonfly. That's the point. And never at any time has anyone been able to show a moth that turned into a dragonfly, okay, or a cat that turned into a dog. Now, it is important to understand Darwin from the standpoint of his upbringing. He was raised in the Unitarian Universalist Church. Church in its broadest sense, okay? Unitarians believe that each person is free to search for their own personal truth. There is no absolute truth to the universalist. There is only personal truth. On the issues of existence, nature, the meaning of life, deities, creation, or the afterlife, each person is free to think and work his way through to his own definition of those things. They believe in everything, consequently, they believe in nothing. Okay. They have no creed, but they are unified by a shared search for spiritual growth. As such, you can be a Baptist, a Catholic, a Lutheran, a Hindu, a Buddhist, an atheist, an agnostic, or anything in between, and still be welcomed and be part of a Unitarian Universalist congregation. That was what Darwin was raised in. Now, I was told in my high school biology class that Darwin was a Christian because he was raised in church. Okay? But he wasn't raised in a church that we would be familiar with. And when we say church, we automatically think a certain shared group of things that would be true about that organization. And the Universalist Church shares none of those. So as a result of that, Darwin was primed to see not the God of creation at work, but something else at work when he observed these finches. Okay? So the problem was, I said, well, how could somebody raised in church as a kid? How could somebody raised in church believe this stuff? I didn't understand it because I didn't know what universalism was. Universalists also believe that everyone will eventually be reconciled to God, if there is one. And there is no absolute truth. Jesus is not God, but he was a great moral teacher. Now, because no one has ever shown a moth becoming a dragonfly or a cat becoming a dog, evolutionists are intensely interested in finding what they call missing links. A missing link would be an individual that shows both the characteristics of a dragonfly and the characteristics of a moth, or would have an individual that would have both the characteristics of a dog and a cat. Okay, and these they call missing links. As a result of that, evolution has been subject to hoaxes over the years. Because they so desire to find the missing link, they tend to suspend disbelief when presented with, what is a missing link? Okay. When I was in my high school biology class, I'm going to teach you a phrase today that will make you sound extremely intelligent and will win every argument that you ever get into. Okay? Ready? You ready for this? Okay. That phrase is ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. So, if you're in an argument with somebody and they say, well, yes, but ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, that ends the argument. Why? Because nobody knows what that means, right? Do you know what it means? Okay. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Okay. Scientifically, the word ontogeny refers to the change that an individual goes through from conception to birth. So the embryological development of an individual. That's ontogeny. Phylogeny is the evolutionary steps that occurred over an immense period of time that the ancestral form became the fish. or the dog, or the cat, or the human. Okay? So a man named Ernst Haeckel, who is a German scientist, formulated the theory which is called recapitulation theory, which is stated ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. He produced a series of embryological drawings. Remember, this is the 1800s. He was a contemporary of Darwin. That purported to show the changes that created a fish in all the previous ancestors of that fish through evolutionary change produced the fish. And he did it for humans, and he did it for goats, and a couple other animals. In my high school biology, we were taught ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, and Ernst Haeckel's drawings were in my high school biology book in the 1960s. By that time, 1960, that had been shown to be a complete hoax. Haeckel had overemphasized certain structures within the embryos to make them look the way he did in his drawings, and they had bore no relationship to actual embryological development of any of these individuals. But it was still taught in 1960, that decade, even though it had been disproven in the early 1900s, and no scientist considered recapitulation theory to be accurate at that time, but it was still taught at that time. So there's this tremendous inertia that occurs where changes when the PhDs in these things know things are either not right or are right, it takes a long time before that percolates down to average folk. Okay? So Haeckel was a German. He was a member of the Lutheran Church, but that's because that was the state church of Germany, and everyone born in Germany at that time was a Lutheran. Automatically. Okay. So he also had no real Christian training. Okay. Another hoax we call the Piltdown Chicken. Piltdown Chicken occurred in 1999, so not that long ago. There was this huge splurge in National Geographic that we had finally found a missing link that proved that birds descended from dinosaurs. They had a fossil. Finally, thank God, if they believed in God, there was a fossil that was part dinosaur and part bird. We're done. Evolution is real. There is no God. There is no personal God. We are autonomous individuals and free to live our lives exactly as we wish or as our culture dictates. However, the National Geographic announced this at a news conference on October 15th, 1999. There was only one problem, and that was the little Chinese guy in Mongolia knew that the paleontologists, which are the guys that study fossils, were insanely desirous of finding a fossil that was part bird and part dinosaur. So he said, fine. He took a fossil of a bird, he took a fossil of a dinosaur, put them together, handed it to the paleontologists, voila. We have a fossil that is part bird and part dinosaur. The only problem, two fossils put together that were unrelated. National Geographic did not hold a news conference to tell the world that they had been duped by this little Chinese guy and his yak in Mongolia. Mongolia is where they find a lot of fossils. Okay. So the absence of true missing links is a very serious problem for evolutionary theory. And the ones that they have found could be explained by just being a separate species. Because typically what happens in the fossil record is that a species occurs suddenly, It exists unchanged for a long period of time, and this disappears suddenly. That's what the fossil record tells us. Back in Darwin's day, when people would bring this up, you have no missing links. You cannot show us species changing and genuses changing. They said that's because the fossil record is incomplete. We haven't been able to get enough of them yet to be able to show it. 200 years later, the fossil record has been filled in substantially. They still are unable to find missing links that are unquestionably a missing link. There was recently a situation where they had come up with a little probably bipedal ape-like creature that we were told showed that the descent of man... Now, I need to step at one thing. Evolution does not teach that humans descended from apes. Okay, does not teach that. It teaches that at some point, immensely long ago, apes and humans had a common ancestor. Okay? And then evolutionary change caused a divergence from that ancestor to a line that eventually led to human beings and a line that led to the great apes. Okay, so no evolutionists would say you descended from an ape. They would say that apes and humans had a common ancestor at some point in time. That would be the missing link. Okay? And they can't find it. Also, in my high school biology book, there was a bird which was called Archaeopteryx. That means ancient bird. That was purported to be a missing link between birds. Remember, they just had one. This was back in the 1800s that they found Archaeopteryx. In 1999, they were still susceptible to being duped by this. So Archaeopteryx was touted as a missing link, but when it was looked at closely, the feathers were absolutely the same feathers as birds have today, and feathers are extremely complex structures. The way a feather hooks itself together is extremely complex. And if an evolution occurs as a series of very tiny changes over time, the feathers of Archaeopteryx should have been not mature feathers of today, which they were. They had actual imprints of the feather. They could actually look at it in the fossil and see that it was just the same as a chicken feather today. So ornithologists were looking at the feathers, and they said, oh, wait a minute. This is not a missing link between dinosaurs and birds. This is a bird because it has bird-like characteristics. It could perch. You know, perching birds, they can't run very good because the shape of their feet, which favors perching, does not favor running. And yet this Archaeopteryx had perching feet. So there could be no way that this was a transitional form from dinosaur to bird. Okay, he was a fully developed bird. And the reason this happens is, what we have to understand is that PhDs... Louder? Sorry. PhDs know a lot about very little. And a paleontologist, PhD, knows nothing about ornithology, the study of birds. A PhD paleontologist would not be able to make an argument of what is a bird because he doesn't know what a bird is. I mean, yeah, he knows what a robin looks like, but he cannot scientifically define a bird. Very important. Geologists know nothing about paleontology or ornithology or zoology or embryology. Okay? They know a whole lot about very little. And so consequently, the paleontologists feel that the geologists have already proved uniform changes in our environment led to the world that we see today. And the geologists believe that the paleontologists have proven that the fossil record supports the very same thing. But it doesn't. Okay? It doesn't. And it's because there's no Renaissance man in science today. The science is too sophisticated. There's too much information. You can only know a lot about very little. And so consequently, when the paleontologist looked at the fossil of Archaeopteryx, because of his bias, he said this is a link between dinosaurs and birds. And the ornithologist came along eventually and looked at the fossil and said, oh, no, it's not. It's a bird. It's just an old, extinct bird. And you cannot prove evolution from one genus to another based on this. Now, there are currently there is a argument against evolution as chance over time. And this argument is known as intelligent design and is expressed as irreducible complexity. Okay, I'd like you to look at your first page of your handout. And I would like you to consider the humble mousetrap. Okay. Remember, evolution says tiny little changes over a long period of time led to the development of a mousetrap from the standpoint of biology. But we're using this as an example, okay? So a mousetrap is made up of a platform, a catch mechanism, a spring, a holding bar, and a hammer that squashes the little mouse's head when he tries to grab the cheese, okay? And it works really well. Unfortunately, I catch mice all the time at our house, which is not happy for my wife. It doesn't bother me. There's an occasional mouse dropping on the shelves in the pantry, but it bothers her a whole lot. Okay. Now think about this. If a mutation occurred in the mousetrap and the holding bar was too long or too short, would the mousetrap work? No. If a mutation occurred in the spring and the spring was too strong so that the holding bar catch mechanism couldn't hold it in its stored energy form, which is the hammer down, whack, okay, the mousetrap also wouldn't work because you couldn't set it. If the catch was too short or too long, or wasn't it even there, you couldn't set the trap. So the argument of irreducible complexity says this: if there is a system that has three or more parts that are necessary for its function, they cannot be changed gradually because all of the parts would have to be changed at the same time in the same way in order for the mousetrap to function. And this was formulated by a biochemist from Lehigh University named Michael Behe. And he formulated, along with other men, the concept of intelligent design. So what Behe says is, when we look at structure and we see incredible complexity of that structure, that can't occur by chance if there are three or more components to the structure. They have to be all together at the same time. And evolution does not allow for that. It does not allow for three positive mutations to occur in three separate components at the same time. Now, in our backyard, I have a pulley attached to the house and a pulley attached to the oak tree 50 feet away. And there's a string of rope between the two, and I or my wife can hang wash from our back porch from one spot. We don't have to walk along the clothesline to put the clothes on. Okay? A block and tackle is made up of pulleys and rope and a way to hook it someplace, just like my two pulleys are. So similarly to a block and tackle, I have a pulley and I have a rope. But my clothesline is not a block and tackle. And it can't function as a block and tackle because it doesn't have the right numbers of pulleys and the right arrangement of size to one another to allow for the multiplication of my muscle strength through that mechanism so that I could lift an engine block off the ground with my block and tackle. Okay. Although it has a pulley and it has a rope, both of them have the same. But if I made any change in the block and tackle, it wouldn't function. Just as if I made any change, if I took one of the pulleys away from my clothesline, it wouldn't work that way. And if you took one of the pulleys away from the block and tackle, it wouldn't work that way. Or you took the rope away. Okay? So just because, and if you think about that, that's an important concept, because an intelligent designer would say, pulley, clothesline. You know, I could probably use a bunch of pulleys and make a block and tackle. So he wouldn't redesign a separate mechanism for his block and tackle. A smart designer would say, this will work if I make these changes in it. So for certain structures in a living organism to have similar form and shape does not mean that one derived from the other through small changes. It just means you had a really smart designer that said, I can use this and I can add this to it, and now I've got a totally different thing. Okay? Now that's complex, but you think about it from the standpoint of a block and tackle and a clothesline on a pulley. Okay, second page of your handout. The top figure is a detailed drawing of an electromicrograph of a bacterial flagellum. A flagellum is a long thread on the back of a bacteria that spins in a rotary motion that allows the bacteria to be motile in fluid. Okay. You're seeing the outside and inside cell wall. Now you look at that thing and then you look below it. This is a line drawing representative of that same structure. The structure on top is an actual micrograph of a flagellum. The drawing on the bottom is a line drawing representation of the same thing. And what you've got here is you've got a motor that spins at 1,500 RPMs a second. It has a shaft that goes up through bushings between the outside and inside of the cell wall, and then it changes inside the hook that you're converting this movement to this movement. And that is exactly what a flagellum is. It is an incredibly efficient motor. It's an outboard motor for a bacteria. That's what it is, with a propeller, only the propeller is a long filament as opposed to what we think of as a propeller. Okay? He says, you cannot look at that and think that that was not designed, because we can take that and we can make the same thing out of metal and produce exactly the same structure doing exactly the same thing, except we as humans can't make it spin at 1,500 revolutions per second, not per minute. This is per second. So then you add a zero to that 1,500. That's 15,000 revolutions a minute. Well, you see what I'm talking about. Times six, that's 90,000 revolutions a minute. Any motor you know of goes 90,000 revolutions per minute? I don't know of any. Okay. So we can't make a motor, even though we've got the design to follow, that's as efficient as this one. And so Behe says, this is an example of intelligent design. This could not have occurred spontaneously. There's too many parts. And there's no way that these parts could have been, they have to all be present at the same time in the same configuration in order for them to work. Evolutionists hate intelligent design. And why would that be? Because if you admit to the existence of an intelligent designer, standing directly behind that designer must be what? A creator God. And remember, evolutionists will do anything. They will make any mental gymnastics possible to deny the existence of a creator God. And the reason is very simple. If there is a creator God, he might be interested in his creation. If he is interested in his creation, he might be interested in what I do in that creation. If he is interested in what I do, he might be pleased or displeased with what I do. And if he is pleased or displeased with what I do, he might be punishing me or rewarding me for what I do. Okay? So understand, committed evolutionists, although they call themselves scientists, are nonetheless religionists. Because religion, the religion of the evolutionist is chance over time, immense periods of time. So anything that would indicate design, intelligent design, is anathema to them because of that. And so they will fight it tooth and nail, even though it's obvious when you look at this, because of the numbers of parts in that flagellum, that there is no way that that could have been built up gradually over time. Because remember, natural selection works on a trait that is favored in the environment. And until that flagellum is actually functioning, it has no value to the organism. So it cannot be. It wouldn't work that way. Natural selection would, and natural selection exists. There's no question about it. But it doesn't equal evolution, change of one genus to another. Okay, we got a minute. Any questions? The takeaways from this is there are no proven missing links. That's the most important thing. And that any system made up of three or more components cannot change by gradual change in one component at a time. And the likelihood of three or more beneficial mutations occurring at the same time is statistically impossible. The vast majority of mutations are not helpful, they're harmful, as my grandson's mutation was. Is. All right. I got through it. I hope I did not confuse anyone. Oh, on the back of your handout is the argument about Archaeopteryx. It's three pages, and it's entitled Feathered Dinosaur or Real Bird? And it's very simple reading. They did a very good job with this, and it tells you why the ornithologist ornithologist said, I don't know where birds came from in terms of ancestry. But one thing is certain, flight evolved from the trees down. This other theory, that flight evolved from the ground up, is pure paleo babble. Yes, Lee.
I have one comment. The pastor a week or two ago spoke about the casting of the lot to determine the allocation of the promised land to the
children. Okay, yeah.
Israel. It was indicated that those lots were God's way of determining the outcome of the allocation. In other words, what we call chance, the casting of a lot, or random, or statistical, is another scientific terminology to describe the phenomenon called chosen by God. So in the same way, time plus chance is the evolutionist. Well, if you look underneath the word chance, it's chosen by God. So,
well, yeah,
so God has chosen even the outcomes of those random occurrences.
Yes, I agree with that. Right, because then what are we faced with as individuals?
Yeah.
We are faced with dealing with the chance, the choice that God has made for us in our life. You know, it's like they say, there's no... emotions are neither good or bad. It's what we do with them. I can be angry. And I may have a good reason to be angry or a bad reason to be angry, but if I don't act on that anger in either a negative or positive way, it's neutral. If I become spiteful, now I've made a choice to do with my anger a bad thing. If I take the anger and I say, okay, why am I angry about this? Well, because they criticized me. All right. Was the criticism justified? Well, yeah, it was. Okay, now I can say, all right, I'm going to take that anger and I'm going to work on the justified criticism and change that so that it's no longer true about me. So what we do with that anger can be good or bad. The anger itself is not necessarily, is not good or bad. It's what we do with it. And the one thing, I do have one other question. I'll take 1 minute to do this. What is the preeminent attribute of God? What is the attribute of God that is more important than any of the others? Nope. It's important. Truth. God is truth. If he's truth, 100% perfect truth, then we can count on what he has told us to be true, because we're going to be held to that standard. So we can be confident in our Bible that what's there is what we're supposed to know. Okay? If God were not truth, he could not be the God that we serve. He would be capricious. And he is not that. He never changes. And again, that's Dr. Pickering's, not mine. I didn't come up with that on my own. But that was his point. And the point he was making was, if we cannot depend on the Word of God to be true, we are in trouble. But we can, because God is truth. He always will be true. His truth never changes. What was true for Adam and Eve is true for us today, as far as obeying. Okay.